From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with military historian Clay Blair. His new book, The Forgotten War, examines the Korean War, a war marked by out-of-date U.S. military strategy, racism in the military, and McCarthyism at home. Also today, I speak with film director Bob Swaim, best known for his French film La Balance. He describes his new film, Masquerade, as a film noir for the 80s. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc release of the late Arturo Toscanini, not in performance, in rehearsal. And humorist Alice Kahn examines one of the oddest but longest-lasting relationships around, Ken and Barbie. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Many Americans remember the Korean War primarily for its role as the setting of the TV series MASH. Military historian Clay Blair calls the Korean War the Forgotten War, but he thinks we shouldn't allow it to slip from our collective memory. He would like to remind us that close to 4.5 million people on both sides were murdered, wounded, or incapacitated as a result of the war. American intervention in Korea helped set the stage for our involvement in Vietnam. And the Korean War fostered a national climate in America that strengthened the appeal of McCarthyism. The United States sent troops to Korea in 1950 after communist troops from North Korea invaded the South. The war ended in 1953 after a negotiated settlement. Historian Clay Blair is a former military correspondent for Time magazine and the author of the bestseller Silent Victory about the U.S. submarine war against Japan. His new book, The Forgotten War, America in Korea, is published by Times Books. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York and asked him why he thought Korea had become the Forgotten War.
Possibly because after 1 year of very difficult and dramatic and exciting fighting, the war bogged down into negotiations that went on for about 2 years, and the fighting continued. But the news became very boring. These negotiations were very complex. The story drifted off the first front pages and were put, you know, in the back of the paper. There was no TV to remind us. The people were against the war, and they were very happy not to hear about it. And then we segue it into the Eisenhower years, where, as you know, the Eisenhower generation was not demonstrative, not rebellious, and sort of bland. And so, I don't know, for a number of reasons, it just drifted off into history and is not remembered.
There are a lot of themes from the Korean War that have remained themes in American military and politics. For instance, the Korean War was the first war that we fought to contain the spread of communism.
Yes, this is true. Up until that time, we had been engaged in what was known as the Cold War. This was the first hot war in our relationship with Moscow. Up to this time, as a matter of fact, we had more or less disarmed as a nation. We had cut our defense forces, conventional forces, to the bone and had virtually no military power. One result of the Korean War was that we rearmed, the whole nation rearmed, and we remain so to this day, a militaristic state. I think that was one of the most significant outcomes of the Korean War, often forgotten.
The war in Korea was different strategically than any war we had fought before. How were the battle conditions, for instance, different than they were in World War II?
Well, in a number of ways, Korea is a very mountainous, forbidding place with terrible weather, very bitterly cold in the winter and jungle hot in the summer. It's a peninsula, somewhat like Italy or even Vietnam. And we attempted at first to go in and fight a war that we, a duplicate of World War II in Europe. And this, we were road-bound. We were relying on heavily on artillery and other conventional means of fighting a war. And in fact, the enemy was a guerrilla type of fighter, as they were in later in Vietnam. So we had to really change our outlook about how we fought wars.
Were the generals mostly generals who had fought during World War II and were basically fighting as if it were still World War II?
Yes. This was one of the mistakes we made early in the war. All the generals, most of the generals in Korea, were so-called European generals who were serving in Japan at this time for a little variety in their career. MacArthur, of course, had fought the Japanese all through the Pacific, but he was far removed from the battlefield in Korea. So there was a tendency to repeat what had occurred in Europe, and this did not work against an enemy who had small regard for human life and whose tactics were mass attacks, regardless of casualties or the consequences.
We mentioned the strategy that the Koreans and also the Chinese had during the war of just continuing to mass. And I think from the way you describe it, the number of soldiers, both Chinese and Korean, just really astonished the American generals who were masterminding the war. Now, General MacArthur, who headed up military strategy during the first part of the war, said that basically that he didn't believe that the Chinese could fight a modern army. Was that the general consensus among the American strategists?
It certainly was. MacArthur, you see, I should explain that to our listeners that this war was in two phases. First, the North Koreans invaded South Korea, and we defeated them, and we were well on our way to a good victory. The thinking was, MacArthur said, that the Chinese would not come into the war. And even if they did, as you say, he had such contempt for them as fighters that he would destroy them within a matter of a few weeks, mostly with air power. So when we went into North Korea to liberate North Korea, the Chinese, in fact, did come in huge numbers, as you say, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, without artillery, without air power, without trucks, without radios, and they flung themselves at our forces without any regard for conventional ideas about saving lives or casualties. And we had a very, very difficult time for a period of about 2 months. We were thrown back. We suffered tremendous casualties, all this forgotten, by the way. And there was very grave danger that we would be thrown out altogether, out of Korea. But we were fortunate in that by circumstances, a new general came, Matthew Ridgway, and he took the army that was in full retreat, almost rout, and by his own personal courage and example, turned the army around, and we went on to actually defeat the Chinese. We beat them. We crushed them. We annihilated them by perhaps hundreds of thousands, perhaps in total almost a million casualties were inflicted. Then the Chinese asked for talks, and these talks went on for 2 years. And as I said earlier, they were very frustrating. People became disgusted with the war. It was a new idea in terms of strategy, which was to settle for the status quo, which introduced the concept of a limited war. We had never fought a limited war before. We always went for victory. In this case, we decided that it wasn't worth the effort, that we would settle the war out on the 38th parallel where it started and accept a compromise. And this turned a lot of people against the war because, as MacArthur says, there was no substitute for victory.
Well, a couple of things that you mentioned really sound like themes that were played out again during the war in Vietnam. For instance, to get back to something you were saying a couple of minutes ago, you were discussing how the American military didn't believe that the Chinese would be effective in fighting against a modern army. Now, wasn't it the same way in Vietnam? Didn't we go in there thinking that for sure we would win easily because we had a sophisticated army?
Yes, I think, and not only that, this idea arose in Korea. You have to remember that the young captains and company commanders, platoon leaders and so on, who fought the Chinese and beat them in Korea were, by the time of Vietnam, colonels and generals. So they had come out of Korea with the idea that you could, in fact, fight Asians on Asian soil and beat them. this was a totally at odds with what they had, what we had traditionally, what our doctrine had been. Our doctrine had been never fight Asians in Asia, because it was a losing proposition. Because we had won the war in Korea, these young officers who were in command positions at the time of Vietnam unhesitatingly felt that we could go into Vietnam and easily defeat another Asian army, which did not appear at first to be as formidable as the Chinese.
Isn't there an expression in military history that generals always fight the previous war?
There certainly is, and that was true in the Korean War, and again, I think in Vietnam.
So in the Korean War, we were fighting World War II, and in Vietnam, we were fighting the Korean War.
Exactly, exactly.
Go ahead.
And I hope that we don't repeat this mistake.
What are some of the other ways you think that the Korean War set the stage for Vietnam?
Well, as I said, I think the primary thing was the mindset, the confidence, the overconfidence that that it instilled in the professional Army officer corps. I can't think of any other, offhand, any other reasons that how this war set a stage other than to reinforce our belief that we should interfere in nationalistic civil wars in the Far East, which in my opinion is a terrible mistake.
Clay Blair is my guest. He's a military historian whose new book is titled The Forgotten War, America in Korea, 1950 to 1953. Now, Americans suffered terrible casualties during the Korean War, especially during the first part of the war when the American troops were really unprepared for the kind of fight that they were fighting. Yet, there was never the kind of anti-war movement at home during the Korean War that there was during the Vietnam War. Why do you think that was so?
Right. Well, I think the reason for this is this. When the Korean, all during the post-war period, from 1945 until 50, the Russians had been pushing us around. The communists had been pushing us around in Berlin, in Eastern Europe, and other places. And I think that the general tenor, the feeling among Americans was, we've got to stop Joe Stalin from pushing us around. And when Truman committed us into Korea in order to save South Korea from the communists, the country was really nearly 100% behind him. Let's go. Let's beat these communists. Let's draw the line. Let's show them they can't push us around anymore. So that for a full year, the country supported the Korean War in a most magnificent and patriotic way. It was only when the war, after the first year, when it bogged down in these interminable negotiations, which were very confusing to people, the casualties went on at this, very, very high rate, that people began to turn against the war and express total dissatisfaction with it. But again, I think to demonstrate, to rebel, to hold open riots of any of that type of thing that occurred during the Vietnam War was not the style of the early 1950s of the Eisenhower generation. And even though there was widespread dissatisfaction, nobody burned a draft card.
Well, didn't, in fact, the Korean War help create a climate that made McCarthyism possible?
Yes, that's a very good point. McCarthyism was intensified. You know, once we got into a shooting war, McCarthyism and all kinds of repressive ideologies became very widespread in this country because communists were actually killing Americans in Korea by the thousands. And so there was a natural tendency to fall for large segments of the population to get behind McCarthy and other ideologues like that.
The Korean War was the first post-nuclear war. We had already used the atom bomb in Japan. Everybody knew that we had the atom bomb. Did the United States ever seriously consider using atomic weapons in Korea during the war?
Yes, we did. On a number of occasions, this was very intensely studied. The problem is that the Chinese were so good at camouflage that they were hiding in the mountains, in the valleys and gorges, and never, at no time, in fact, did they ever present a good target, if you will. In other words, one that would be worth an atomic bomb. And because of this, in the mountainous terrain, there was a reluctance to use atomic bombs because, A, they wouldn't be effective. B, if they weren't effective, the negative psychological impact would undermine our deterrent. However, during two or three really tense moments when we thought we were going to be thrown out and that the Chinese or North Koreans would create a Dunkirk, a bloody withdrawal for us, and would have to mass in front of our lines to do that. This was very seriously considered. But again, the worldwide consequences of using an atomic weapon against these primitive Asians would have been, I think, perhaps even disastrous.
Well, what effects do you think the Korean War had on the arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union and China?
Well, I think it fueled it beyond belief. As I said earlier, we had disarmed almost completely before the Korean War. During the Korean War, our government approved a massive rearmament program that goes on right to this day. So it all stems from that conflict. And that was one, I think, one of the most significant consequences of that war.
My guest is Clay Blair. He's a military historian whose new book is titled The Forgotten War, America in Korea, 1950 to 1953. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Military historian Clay Blair is my guest, author of a new book about the Korean War. You bring up a very interesting chapter of military history, and that is the segregation and then the desegregation of America's military. Ever since the Civil War, the troops in America had been officially segregated. In 1948, Truman asked for the desegregation of the troops. Yet, when the Korean War started in 1950, the troops were still segregated. Why hadn't desegregation actually occurred yet?
Well, what you say is true. The Army had segregated blacks within its ranks since the Civil War. And Truman signed an executive order in 1948, a very famous document, asking the Army, Navy, and Air Force to desegregate as rapidly as possible. But the Army was very much opposed to this. Omar Bradley, who was chief of staff at that time, said he did not want the Army to be an instrument of social change. In other words, he felt that America itself should take more aggressive steps toward desegregation and not use the Army as a vehicle for achieving that goal. The Army had deep, extensive commitments in the South. There are many of their bases in Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, and they foresaw that if they desegregated in 1948, it would be possibly disastrous. So you're right. At the time of Korea, black troops were still segregated, and they went into the Korean War that way.
Now, the official military history of the war condemns the performance of the black troops. You've actually investigated what the performance of the black troops really were, and you've come up with a very different picture than the official military history paints.
Yes, I did. The Army, for reasons that are not clear, took a very, very dim view of the performance of black troops in Korea, particularly the 24th Regiment. And the Army, the official Army history, condemns the 24th Infantry in a most severe way. When I started my research on the Korean War, I interviewed many blacks who were in this outfit, and I began to hear a very different story from them. They felt that the Army's history had publicly lynched them, and in fact, they had done very well. And as I researched the war deeper, I found out, in fact, that they had a very good case, that many white regiments, all white regiments in Korea, during the very difficult first year, failed repeatedly and often more so than the 24th. In fact, the 24th did very, very well for a while, but its white leaders were so convinced that blacks couldn't fight. In other words, this was a sort of a, they were programmed to fail, and ultimately they did fail for a while. Then they came back and did very, very well.
The impression I have is that for white military commanders being placed commanding black troops was not considered to be a very good position, not a very prestigious commission, and consequently a lot of the white leadership wasn't very good. That, you know, it was like the lesser leaders that were placed in the command of black troops.
Well, you're absolutely right. It was white officers, professionals, considered it to be the kiss of death for their careers to be assigned to this outfit. And this was a holdover from World War II, where the same viewpoint obtained. Therefore, those officers who commanded in the 24th Regiment were very, very poor for a while. And during the period of setbacks that the regiment incurred, they were led by these, I would say, less inspiring commanders.
Well, the Army has been asked to reinvestigate its findings on the performance of black troops during the Korean War. And I believe that there are two historians and one black general dispatched to basically reopen this case. Will you be consulting on this in any way?
No, I won't. I think that my book, which I gave to the Army some months ago in galley form, in part at least, resulted in the formation of this review board, which, as you say, is headed by a four-star black general, Roscoe Robinson. And I will not be consulted, except that my book, I'm sure, will be read by the full panel, and that my views are that the Army, really my bottom line view on it was that the Army should review and very carefully the kind of statements it had made about the black troops in Korea. There were others as well. There were several other battalions that I follow very closely, and they'll be taking a look at them too. And I think that, I don't know, Pentagon review boards, I don't know what the outcome will be. Yeah, I'm sure they'll meet for a couple of years. Hopefully, they'll do something to give the blacks a better account in the Korean War. They deserve it.
The Korean War was the first war we negotiated our way out of. What effect do you think that had on military morale, and do you think that that affected in any way our entrance into Vietnam?
Well, I think that... negotiations on the battlefield are always very difficult in any situation, and certainly without question, those men who were in Korea, in the Army and Marine Corps, who were fighting on the ground, deeply resented our going into negotiations with the enemy. Of course, soldiers on the battlefield are conditioned to think only of victory, that compromises, negotiations, return soil, often returned soil that's been bought in blood and that type of thing. So, and then who wants to be the last person killed? So it undermines morale in that way, that you could think that I'll go out and really do well tomorrow morning, and by noon they'll have an armistice, and I might get killed or wounded for nothing. So in the very local and parochial sense, yes, it undermined the spirit of the Army tremendously.
We still have, 40,000 troops in
40,000 troops are still sitting on the DMZ, and I'm sure, I don't know, but it certainly has deterred the North Koreans from invading South Korea again. I don't know if they ever had any intention of doing that, but yes, we still have 40,000 troops in Korea.
What's your opinion of the choice of Seoul, South Korea, as an Olympic site?
Well, I think that's very exciting. How that relates to any military endeavor, I don't know. But I think it's really very interesting, and particularly so that the North Koreans are now apparently going to participate in about 5 events there. I don't think that'll change relations between North and South Korea, which are still bitter and hostile.
Let me ask you, what do you think the function is of military history? What function would you like your book on the Korean War to serve?
Well, I like first of all and foremost that this book would get people to remember that we did have a war in Korea. 6 million very brave men and women served in our armed forces. 40,000, 104,000 were wounded in Korea. 54,000 died. There's no monument to them in Washington. No, and the war has been forgotten. I would hope that my book would remind us of that war and settle. I wrote the book more or less as a tribute to all those people who did all that and have gotten no credit, no distinction from the war. Writing military history, I think one would hope that by examining a war in such detail as I have here and raising the major problems that occurred there, such as tactic, strategy, command, black troops, and all the other factors that we go into, that the younger officer corps of today could read this and profit by it.
Do you think the Korean War was a just war?
Yes, I do. I do. I think that we were absolutely correct to go in, but not we should not have done it the way we did it. It was not just on our troops, because we threw troops in there who were not trained or not well led. It was right to try to save Korea, but we could have done it in different ways that would have reduced our casualties. But it was almost criminal to throw our troops in the way we did. But to save South Korea, yes, I think it was worthwhile. And not only that, to show communism, Moscow, wherever, that we could be determined in our resistance to Joe Stalin's aggression. In that sense, yes, I think it was a just war.
Well, Clay Blair, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been military historian Clay Blair. He's the author of the new book, The Forgotten War, America in Korea, 1950 to 1953. It's published by Times Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actor Zakes Mokhai. He broke the color ban in his native South Africa when he and Ethel Fugard were the first black and white actors to perform together on stage. He went on to star in many of Fugard's plays, and he's now appearing in TV shows and films in the United States, including the current films The Serpent and the Rainbow and Cry Freedom. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with film director Bob Swaim. He moved to France 20 years ago to study anthropology, but switched to making movies, among them the 1982 thriller La Balance. He returned to the States to make his new film, Masquerade, which stars Rob Lowe and Meg Tilly. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc that gives a behind-the-scenes look at the late Arturo Toscanini. Lloyd says it's a rare opportunity to hear the maestro's genius and temper. And humorist Alice Kahn analyzes the odd love affair of Barbie and Ken. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. President Reagan said today he will veto the Grove City Civil Rights Bill if it receives final approval in the House. The measure would restore broad anti-discrimination protection, which was narrowed by a Supreme Court ruling in 1984. In a letter to House leaders, Mr. Reagan said the Grove City bill poses a particular threat to religious liberty. The High Court ruled that the federal government may not cut off funds to schools which practice sex discrimination. The court said only the guilty department within the institution may be penalized. The legislation would expand federal sanctions to the entire school. The leaders of the Western Alliance issued a six-page statement today claiming that Soviet conventional superiority casts a shadow over Europe. The heads of the 16 NATO countries called on the Soviets to eliminate tens of thousands of Warsaw Pact weapons. President Reagan said he's pleased with the progress so far at the Brussels conference.
Today's meetings have been extremely productive. There's a strong sense of unity in the alliance, as reflected in the statement on conventional imbalance in Europe. This document is a major step forward for the alliance. The most direct threat to our security and to stability in Europe lies in the Soviet Union's massive military presence at a level far exceeding its defense needs.
NATO and Warsaw Pact countries are currently discussing a framework for future negotiations on conventional forces. The Soviet government acknowledged today that some people were killed in rioting this week in Azerbaijan. Officials report several arrests in connection with 2 days of ethnic violence. More from Jeremy Harris in Moscow.
The chief Soviet spokesman, Mr. Gennady Gerasimov, who'd previously spoken only of casualties without specifying their gravity, confirmed that several people had been killed and others injured during the clashes between Armenians and Azerbaijanis in Sumgait. He gave no precise details about the number of victims, saying there weren't many, nor of their nationality. However, dissident sources in Moscow, who've been generally reliable in filling some of the gaps in the information provided by Soviet officials, suggested the number of dead could be as high as 17, with many more injured. Whatever the final figure, the violence was serious enough for the Kremlin to have taken the highly unusual step of declaring a dusk-to-dawn curfew in the city, enforced by troops in armored personnel carriers. Mr. Gerasimov reaffirmed that the city, the second largest in Azerbaijan, was now calm, although he gave no indication when the curfew would be lifted.
The BBC's Jeremy Harris. President Reagan today ordered Secretary of State Shultz back to the Middle East to resume a push for regional acceptance of a U.S. peace proposal. New home sales plunged 9% in January. The Commerce Department said the decline was the sharpest in 6 years. Doug Diamond of the National Association of Home Builders reacted to the downturn this way.
My immediate reaction is surprise. The numbers were a bit weaker than we expected. The interest rates have been shading down and are in the relatively attractive range. And sales, we thought they did rebound in the Northeast from a rather dismal showing last month, but they've weakened considerably in the South.
It was the third consecutive monthly decline in new single-family home sales. Federated Department Stores said today it has agreed to merge with R.H. Macy & Company in a cash and stock deal worth more than $6 billion. Stock prices moved fractionally higher today in active trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.8 of a point to close at 2017.29. Advances led declines 9-5 on volume of 199 million shares. I'm Sharon Green, reporting for National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Conductor Arturo Toscanini has a reputation for having been a terror in rehearsals, screaming at the orchestra, insulting the players, and throwing tantrums. But our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a recent release that offers concrete evidence that these famous outbreaks were only a small part of the story.
One of the most extraordinary recent opera recordings is a rehearsal for a radio broadcast of the second and third acts of Verdi's La Traviata with Arturo Toscanini and the NBC Symphony. It was taped, without Toscanini's knowledge, of course, in December 1946. Toscanini rehearsals are the stuff of legend. There are dozens of stories about his violent temper, breaking batons, even smashing his watch. "Put something! Put your blood!" he cried at one rehearsal of a minor Italian overture. No music was too trivial for Toscanini to demand everything from an orchestra. In the Traviata rehearsal, Toscanini suddenly blows up at the basses and mimics their sloppy playing. These are short notes and sweet. They must be played that way.
Stringendo! Contrabassi, follow me! E corte note! Short note, short note! So, so, sembrano dei carri. Carri. Non so mica sto meglio. Brr, brr, brr. Come Madonna Santissima. Short note! Ancora vos more.
A moment later, he's all sweetness, indicating how lightly, tutti leggeri, the next passage must sound. And then he loses his patience again. Lighter, softer, sweeter. Don't run away, it's fast enough. Sing, he tells the orchestra over and over, sometimes paternalistically, sometimes almost childlike. And he always gets results. At one point, he tells them a story about when he played cello under Verdi himself. One passage in Otello was marked pianissimo, 4P. Verdi stopped the rehearsal and asked, "Who is the second cello?" "I was so confused," Toscanini admits to his musicians. "I stood up. I, maestro." Then Verdi tells him, "Play a little louder." The moral is that cellos in Verdi have to play out, whatever the score says. Toscanini is a practical musician. Throughout the rehearsal, he keeps modifying the instrumentation. Later in the rehearsal, the street chorus outside Violetta's house sounds too loud, too near. He tells them to try putting their hands over their mouths.
No, it's too near. Troppo vicino. Ma can you sing, try to sing, not so loud, and put your hand before. Try. Don't be afraid. Put. Yes, try.
What comes through clearest in the rehearsal is Toscanini's desire for a singing line. Even on the final recording of the Traviata broadcast, you can hear Toscanini's hoarse voice grunting in the background. In this rehearsal for the orchestra, the only singer is the 79-year-old maestro. One of the most poignant things I've ever heard is Toscanini on this disc trying to croak out the dying Violetta's tragic last act aria, Addio del Passato. Every hope is dead. Farewell, sweet laughing dreams of the past. The roses of my cheeks are already growing pale.
E diminuendo, ogni speranza. Addio del passato, bei sogni, ridere di la rosa del volo, già sono
I think the deepest source of Toscanini's greatness is that he himself wanted to sing but couldn't. That's why you can hear him on his recordings. That may be why he chose the cello. That's why he worked harder than almost any other conductor to get the whole orchestra to sing.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He's also a poet and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed Arturo Toscanini in rehearsal. It's on the Swiss label Relief. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Bob Swaim. For the last 20 years, Swaim has lived and worked in Paris. His career took off in 1982 with the release of his stylish thriller La Balance. It won a César Award, the French equivalent of the Oscar, for Best Film. It was the first French film directed by an American to receive that honor. His first English-language film, Half Moon Street, was made in London with Michael Caine and Sigourney Weaver. Swaim's new film, Masquerade, is the first he shot in the United States. Masquerade is a suspense film that stars Rob Lowe as a smooth-talking hustler who gets involved with a lonely, rich, naive young woman played by Meg Tilly.
What's wrong?
Holly called. Mike McGill went to see her yesterday.
Why?
He was asking all kinds of questions about us.
Officially?
Holly said he was really casual. He wasn't even in uniform.
So he's doing this on his own. Look, what is the story with that guy anyway?
We were really close when we were kids, and I used to tell everybody we were going to get married when we grew up.
Well, so just because it doesn't work out, he wants to send you to the electric chair?
No. You.
What was interesting is to take an actor like Rob Lowe, who has a very strong image of this kind of, teenage heartthrob, you know, and he looks very clean-cut and handsome and everything, and then to give him a dark side. There's an ambiguity among the several of the protagonists in the movie, which I like. There's a moral ambiguity, there's a sexual ambiguity, there are, you know, things just not black and white. And that's something I like in all my movies. There's a gray area that I'm fascinated by.
The movie that you expect to see when Masquerade begins isn't the movie that it ends up becoming. For instance, it starts out really brightly colored, spacious, outdoorsy, and it gets darker and gloomier as the film goes on. I kind of like those changes. Is that something you were really going for?
Yeah, what I wanted to do is classic film noir, but a classic film noir of the 80s. I didn't want to use those long, dark shadows of this kind of RKO Warner Brothers pictures of the 40s. And what I wanted, however, is to have a bright, clean, healthy, wholesome, all-American look to the picture, and then have this very dark undercurrent, which kind of slowly seeps up to the surface, you know, as we get into the piece.
Why did you want it to have a different kind of look, of what you describe as an 80s look, a more brightly colored look, a more outdoors look, more healthy look?
Because I think that's what the 80s is about. I think we're in a period of hypocrisy and deception, where the form is more important than content, and that's the world we live in. That's the world. I think a film has to be a reflection of the times we live in. I mean, who wants to make a 40s picture today? I mean, we can. What I was looking for was the emotional thrust of those 40s pictures, the emotional truth of those pictures. But I think that to make it accessible, for one thing, to audiences today, it has to be something that they can identify with, something they can relate to.
This is the second film that you've made in English. Your other movies have been in French. Do you think the role of the director is different in French movies than in American movies?
I think the role of the director is probably the same everywhere, except in the European cinema, I think a director has more authority in the sense that he has more power. You know, he basically runs the show from A to Z, whereas here there are people above us. We have to answer to people. We have to fight other battles that I don't have to fight in Europe.
Budget-type battles, marketing battles?
Marketing, budget, you know, perception of the movie, and some of the people felt that I was kind of subverting, you know, the story somehow. You know, I wanted to do classic film noir, but I wanted to put a little edge into it, you know, in a certain way that it's a different market, you know, and people often feel they know best. And working in Europe has not been really an advantage in that sense, in the politics of the business, because they can always say, well, we know better, you know. We've been in America doing this for a long time. And, you know, it's an argument that I come up with often. You know, you have to say, well, look, guys, I make movies, regardless of where I come from.
Well, Rob Lowe is one of the stars of your new film, Masquerade. Do you need a Rob Lowe to make a movie now? In other words, do you need someone with that kind of box office draw in order to get a movie produced nowadays?
They think so. You know, I have, they meaning the powers of, well, you know, Hollywood, whatever that means. They definitely feel that you need to open your picture, you need a recognizable name or a star. I was given a list of quote-unquote acceptable actors for the lead in the movie. Now, I chose Rob Lowe simply because there was a certain quality about Rob Lowe. There's a certain, some people say he's too pretty and he's too attractive and this and that. You know, he's almost too perfect. And I thought this could work to my advantage in this particular movie.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I had screened all of Rob's pictures, and he's an actor which has grown in each picture. And I think he's a much better actor than a lot of people give him credit for.
So you were given a list of actors who would be acceptable as the lead. Is this the kind of thing that would never happen in France?
Oh, like never. I don't think it would. I mean, unless you were doing a super production, you know, these kind of things they did in the 60s and 50s, you know, Italian, French-Italian, English production, you know, where you had Gina Lollobrigida in one role and Yves Montand, you know, those kind of international co-productions, because they were like super productions that were supposed to compete with Hollywood movies. But when you're talking about European films, no, because basically the budgets are modest enough and can be supported by the internal markets that you really don't need that kind of star.
Do you want to make more American movies now?
Hey, it's fun. It's hard work, but the stakes are higher. There's a lot more pressure. It's definitely an industry here, and in France it's not. But it is, it's exciting. It's exciting to know that you know, 50 million people or 100 million people or whatever can see your movies. You have just a much wider audience than you do when you make a French picture.
You first went to France to study anthropology with Claude Lévi-Strauss. How were you sidetracked to movies?
I had a maid's room in near Place Trocadéro, which was near the French Cinematheque, and I used to go to school in the morning and come out, and it was really cold. It was the winter of 65, 66, and this maid room didn't have any heat, and friends would say, come to the Cinematheque, and I didn't know what it was, you know, Cinematheque. I wasn't into movies at all. And I'd go over with some of my French friends, and they had this film museum and Cinematheque where you'd go in basically at 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon and watch movies until midnight. And it used to cost, in those days, with a student card, about 25 cents. And I would watch anything, you know, Chinese pictures with Lithuanian subtitles and, I mean, just weird stuff. Because Henry Longua, who was the director of the French Cinematheque, I mean, just collected everything and anything. And it was really exciting. It's like when I was in school in America, we used to sit around and talk about poetry and writers and everything. And the French had the same kind of passion for films, which in those days, this was the, you know, early and mid-60s, the film thing had not really caught on. There were only a couple of universities which gave film courses in America. There were a handful of film books. I mean, it was totally different than it is today. And it was really exciting to see all these young French film buffs and intellectuals, you know, sit around and talk about movies. And I just kind of got caught up in it.
You started your adult life as a social anthropologist. That's what first brought you to France. Do you think that your interest in anthropology has led you into certain subjects in your films?
Social anthropology, I don't think, is the cause. I think it's the symptom, maybe, of something. I think I was interested in people, and it was a way to explore people. And I always wanted to be a writer as a kid, and I wasn't a writer. And I found that film is also another way to explore people and situations. When you're a filmmaker, it's funny. You can go anywhere, and doors open, and you have access to people and situations. And basically, you're an observer. If you're a filmmaker, you're like an anthropologist. You sit and you watch people, and then you reflect upon it. And I think that's what filmmaking is.
Bob Swain, I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Bob Swain's new film, Masquerade, opens nationally on March 11th. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, Terry, new federal rules were scheduled to go into effect tomorrow, barring federal funds to clinics that offer any information whatsoever on abortion. And although these rules will not go into effect tomorrow because they're now in court, they've been challenged by clinics around the country. We visited a family planning clinic to see how they now counsel their patients on the choices they have when they are pregnant, and speak with the legislative director of the National Right to Life organization, who argues that while abortion is legal, the federal government isn't legally bound to give out information on abortion.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some people think that the relationship between Barbie and Ken is just child's play, but these dolls have been together for over a quarter of a century. Humorist Alice Kahn has delved into the dynamics of this duo, and she has these thoughts to share about Ken.
In his 28 years of existence, no one has looked carefully at the life of Ken, Barbie's boyfriend. I intend to show you that Ken represents the American male's worst nightmare, a guy who is little more than an accessory to a gal. After an extensive investigation into Ken's background and a detailed interview with Ken's spokeswoman, Candace Irving, of Mattel Toys, I think I know what lurks beneath that hard plastic hollow torso, Mark Ken, copyright 1960. Let's set the record straight. Ken is not gay. Rumors about Ken's sexual orientation surfaced several years ago when an anatomically correct gay doll named Bob came out of the closet. Bob, however, is not to be perceived as Ken's little friend. In fact, according to Ken's publicist, Bob is not even made by Mattel. Bob is in a different market than Ken. Bob is for adults. Ken's very lack of anatomical anything makes it questionable whether he's even straight. But he certainly may be perceived as a total wimp. He exists for no other reason than to serve Barbie. I asked Irving how she imagines Ken spending his day, and she said, "Oh, I think he's mowing Barbie's yard or checking on Barbie's pool or working as Barbie's handyman." I asked, "Doesn't this get a bit oppressive?" I was hoping to get her to admit that Ken's life is hell, but Irving is a PR pro. She said, "Well, he is going out with the world's most famous woman." Ken's fashions have occasionally hinted at an independent existence for the 11 3/4 inch hunk. Over the years, we have seen outfits for Dr. Ken, Fountain Boy Ken, Mr. Astronaut Ken, Roving Reporter Ken, and even a turned-on, tuned-in Groovy Ken in 1969. Irving is upbeat about Ken's future. She says he has a completely different look this year, more GQ. His features are more sculpted, and the new Ken has rooted hair. Nothing like this has happened since the mid-70s, when mod hair Ken had rooted hair down to his shoulders, and new-look Ken came with decal beard, sideburns, and two mustaches. In all the years after, Ken's head was topped with nothing but molded plastic. An anxious nation watches this hairy hero. Will he, like Samson, put on more power with his locks? Will the new Ken be more macho to compete with such rivals as G.I. Joe? Alas for Ken. His market position necessitates his eternal wimpiness. Irving explains, G.I. Joe is a boy's toy, no offense to Madonna. Boys view Ken as being a girl's toy exclusively. Although they may play with him at a girl's house, they wouldn't want the stigma of having their friends know. So, as feminists snicker and empowered men beat the drum for his absent maleness, Ken stares blankly into toy purgatory, and of course, the guy's only doing it for some doll.
Alice Kahn is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Her latest book is a collection of essays titled My Life as a Gal.
Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love. And when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. He'll look at me and smile.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Walter Polovchak. He was a 12-year-old Ukrainian immigrant living with his family in Chicago when his parents decided to move back to the Soviet Union, and he refused to go. The resulting court case provoked a storm of controversy that ended only when he turned 18 and was sworn in as an American citizen. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review new records by Rick Springfield and Lisa Hartman, two soap opera stars with rock records. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Hairspray, John Waters' homage to the TV dance shows of the 60s. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.